Good morning, my name is Basil. I'm the chairperson of the Standing Committee on Education. And let me first and foremost upfront ask, tender my apology for not being here last week. And I can assure you I missed you. And I'm just glad to be back. Next to me is Wasima Asenmosa, our coordinator, left and right hand, and the one who really keeps me on my toes. And we also say Marianne Burgess, our assistant coordinator. Thank you, Marianne, for always being there. And then we have our senior coordinator, Ben Daza, who's also assisting us today with his presence. I always also welcome the language practitioners, the translators at the back. They fulfill a very vital function in terms of us to understand the lingua franca and the vernacular. Also to make us communicate with one another. I'm going to ask the rest of the committee to introduce themselves.
Good morning, Ricardo McKenzie.
Good morning, Lorraine Botha.
Goeiemôre, voorsitter Dylan Mitchell.
Good morning, Theo Olive.
Good morning, Chair Cameron Dugmore.
Good morning, Father and Christians.
Good morning, Ben Daza.
Good morning, Andre Leroux, Legal Advisor, Provincial Parliament.
And you?
Good morning, Sally Abrams, WCED.
Good morning, Thomas Chilisa, WCD.
Good morning, Kubeshni Govinda, WCD.
Sigamani Naika, Western Cape Education Department.
WCED, Archie Lewis.
Good morning, everybody. Lynn Culbridge-Vold, WCED.
Good morning, Amanda Tor, Department of the Premier Legal Services.
Thank you so much, and we have members of the public at the back. Can you just move to the mic? Right. Last week we had, in my absence, but I was spiritually connected with the rest of the team, so I exactly know what happened, even though I wasn't physically present. We had Amanda Tor, our legal advocate, Tor, presenting the case of the legal opinion of the WCED. She also made a printout available, and she's took us through the steps. Now is the time. Let me just see. Please note, members and public, this committee meeting is a continuation of last week's meeting, when the committee requested that the discussion around the legal opinions be set aside for another date. Now, the core critical focus of this specific day, the purpose of this meeting is to allow the Western Cape Provincial Parliament's legal advisor, Advocate Leroux, to brief the committee on his legal opinion on the Western Cape Provincial School Education Amendment Bill, B1 2018, and to allow his response to WCED's opinion. It's actually a two-prong approach. First the opinion, and then the response. Andre Leroux, Advocate Andre Leroux. It's all over to you. Thank you.
Chair, before the legal advisor gives his input, in your absence there was a rule invoked at our last meeting, and you correctly are saying this is a continuation of that meeting. We want to just be sure and so that it's again on record that the status quo that the public is only observing at this meeting, does that continue? Are you still applying that rule invoked by the chair, acting chair in your absence? So does it mean that because it's a continuation, those rules apply, so the public will just be there and look beautiful and not say anything? So can I just get that on record, because we really want to you know, understand that approach. Maybe can you just confirm to
yes, that? Yes, we'll continue with the meeting and see what emanates and what time is being left.
No, Chair. I think maybe the either the coordinator or the acting chair must just acquaint with that with the decision of the meeting last time when we walked out. The decision was the public at that meeting is not going to speak, and this is a continuation. And we are asking, she did not rule whether there's time or not time. She said it's closed. The public will be observers, because of whatever the reasons were, according to her. So now I want to understand, because it's a continuation, are we still applying that very same decision taken? Because it's not, I just want to understand, because then we know what is the status of the public there.
Thank you, Member. Will you please, Member Buerta?
Chair, thank you. I think I need to refresh Member Olifi's mind to last week. The decision that the acting chair took then, that is that it is a meeting, the committee meeting is open to the public, however, it is not a public hearing.
Okay. Member Olivier.
Chair, Chair, I think the reason, let me just also, I hear what the Chair is saying, but I think she's not concluding. Because we've made a request and she rejected it. So I just want them to read the decision they took last week, so that it is on record, so that we just know, because the chair indicated this, we accept it was a public meeting, but she said at that meeting the public is not going to be allowed to speak, and that's what I'm asking. We accept this is a public, the public can be there, that's why they sit there. But in many other meetings, you allowed, when the time permits, for the public to raise a question based on what was discussed at the meeting. We all knew it's not a public hearing, but it's an open meeting. And that's what we've been asking. And I'm asking, are we continuing with that specific decision taken, Chair?
Chair, I think Olivier is now playing with semantics here. The decision was taken in committee. Chair, I can have your attention. The decision was made in committee last week, and we voted on it. And then Member Olifir chose to withdraw from the meeting. And you have said that this is a continuation of the last meeting. And I'm just reminding him when the decision was taken and how it was taken. He's taking us back and playing with semantics.
I think I'll have to... I'm terribly sorry, I'm not a dictator, but that's the last thing I want to be. But for the sake of progress, we'll have to move on.
Chair, I accept we can move on, but okay. I'm a member of this committee. All I'm asking is that the decision taken, I will continue on that basis, that the public is here, but they are not going to be allowed to speak. Whether we took the decision in committee or not in committee, it's immaterial and it's not semantics. Because we've raised this issue, and the reason why we walked out, Chair, is because we did not agree to the notion that the public cannot speak while they were able to speak at many meetings. And all I'm asking here, it's not rocket science. I'm asking whether the public... Yes, I know it's democracy. All I'm asking is that it's an open meeting, but the public is not going to be allowed to speak. That's all I'm asking, Chair. If you clarify that to me...
I think I should write the inception, if time allows, then it is possible.
Okay.
I don't want to just take us back, Chair, but I think that Member Botha did make a ruling at
No, you can't interfere.
I think that the Chairperson made a ruling, and let's continue with the ruling the Chairperson made. Thank you.
Right, Mr. André Leroux, thank you.
Chair, thank you. Let me just make sure that everybody can hear me. Can everybody still hear me? Chair, thank you. As you know, on the 8th of August this year, I made my opinion available to this committee. So there's the initial document that the committee received. I've raised four issues in that opinion, which is of course not unusual in committees dealing with provincial bills. On the 28th of August, which is not last week, it was the week before that, the Western Cape Department of Education, Ms. Tor, on their behalf, expressed views on that initial opinion, and then of course I was asked to do two things today. The first one being to address the committee on the initial opinion, and then of course to express my views on the department's response to that. It's maybe not the ideal way to do it. It might have been ideal if if I didn't have to respond to both at the same time. My approach, Chairperson, I've made a let me call it a reply available to the committee this morning. I'm going to focus on the views expressed there, and I think most of those views encapsulates what was said in the or relates to what was said in the initial opinion, except for maybe in the latter part, I will rely mostly on the initial opinion. Maybe for purposes of to make things simpler, and as I indicate in the opinion I made available this morning, when I address the committee, when I refer to the initial opinion, the first opinion, I'm going to call it the legislature's opinion, by which of course I don't mean that that will necessarily be the committee's view, I just mean that is the opinion that was produced administratively by the legislature, and then I'll refer to the department's opinion as the department's opinion, just so that everybody knows what we are speaking about. Chair, I think there are four important issues. I think it's important to observe that on many issues I'm in agreement with the provincial department. For example, there were some unfortunate reports that made some statements to the effect, for example, that national legislation prevails over provincial legislation, that I expressed such a view, which is of course not the case, and which is quite clear from the initial opinion. The four issues. Firstly, and I think maybe the most interesting issue, and the one that is also likely to be the most cumbersome, is the interpretation of Section 146.6. I expressed a view on that in the legislature's opinion. The department does not share that view, and I would like to address the committee on that a bit further. The other issue of concern was whether, as far as the governing bodies of collaboration schools and public-funded donor schools are concerned, whether there are irreconcilable conflicts between the provincial bill and the National Act, or SASA, as it's mostly referred to here. The third issue is the issue of whether there's an irreconcilable conflict between the regulations in terms of SASA, in as much as it concerns the sale and consumption of alcohol at public schools. And then the fourth issue is the issue in relation to intervention facilities, whether
that is a lawful delegation of subordinate lawmaking power, or whether it's an unlawful delegation of plenary or parliamentary lawmaking power. I'm going to focus on those four issues. Chair, I'm going to start with some comments on interpretation of Section 146(6) of the Constitution. This issue is important because it's not only relevant to this particular bill, but it's also relevant to any other provincial legislation in future, where the province makes laws on concurrent competences in terms of Schedule 4. So this is actually something which is likely to arise time and time again. And it is an interesting issue, because there are various views, and I'll go through that. There are various views on how Section 146(6) should be properly interpreted, and on what it was intended to mean. The point in the, as I said, the legislature's opinion was basically the following, and here I'm at paragraph 6 of the opinion I made available this morning. Now, that was the focus of the opinion. Even if it is conceded that there are no irreconcilable conflicts between the bill and the National Act, or if there are irreconcilable conflicts, it's conceded that this bill, this provincial bill, should, in terms of subsection 2 and subsection 3 of section 146 of the Constitution, prevail over the National Act, which is probably the case, but I'm not going to express a definitive opinion on that. It is still important to look at the mechanism or the process which is constitutionally intended by which the provincial bill will prevail. So we agree that the provincial bill should prevail for sake of argument, but what is the constitutionally intended process for settling that, for whether that is the case or not? As I expressed in the legislature's opinion, my view was, and still is, that Section 146(6) refers to Acts of Parliament and Provincial Acts. Now, unfortunately, and this I did not do in the legislature's opinion, in order to explain why that is the view, I need to undertake a bit of an interpretative analysis, a bit of an interpretation of statutes approach, which may not be the most exciting thing this committee has ever heard, but it will nevertheless be necessary. Right. So the point of departure being, I think it's common cause, I think everybody here probably agrees, that the Constitution intends for provinces to make their own laws on Schedule 4 matters. I think that's trite, that's fairly obvious. I also agree, and in the legislature's opinion I quoted from a case in paragraph 3 of that opinion. I think it's a common cause point of departure that the Constitution provides for the general prevalence of provincial laws over national laws in respect of Schedule 4 matters. So as a point of departure, generally, if a province makes a law on a Schedule 4 matter, then generally that law will prevail over a national law with a similar scope, applicable to a similar competence, unless certain factors are present, and then those factors are stated in subsection 2 and subsection 3 of section 146 of the Constitution. I also think this is important as a general principle, because it relates to the constitutional principles on which the Constitution was based, and these are the kind of things that was discussed by the Constitutional Court at the time that the Constitutional Court was asked to certify the Constitution. So the question was asked, is there adequate space for the provincial legislatures to have a measure of authority to make laws on matters that are applicable in the provinces? And of course the compromise was, in certain matters, notably here the Schedule 4 matters, the provinces have a measure of prevalence to determine how things should happen in that province. However, the Constitution also recognizes that there may be conflicts between provincial laws and national laws. And of course, I think everybody will agree it is not ideal for there to be conflicts of laws, because then we have law enforcement officers and just general members of the public trying to figure out which law applies to them and which law does not apply to them. And from that perspective, the Constitution in Section 146, maybe up to and including Section 150, created a process and created some principles to determine which laws should apply and which doesn't. As I said, so in the legislature's opinion, I expressed the view that Section 146.6 applies to provincial acts and to acts of parliament. The department views it differently, and the department argues that Section 146.6 of the Constitution, and I quote here, is referring to subordinate legislation made in terms of either an act of parliament or a provincial act. So that's the interpretation. It only applies to subordinate legislation made in terms of an act of parliament or a provincial act. As I indicate in my opinion, I don't go through all the details either of the legislature's opinion or the department's opinion or even this opinion, and that would take too long, but of course all the information is there to be referred to. I also think this is an important point of departure. Section 146 in general, and I think most lawyers will agree with this, is difficult to interpret. There does seem on the face of it to be inherent irrationalities. There seems to be things that just doesn't quite add up. So one is in a situation where one, as one always does with a statute or with a constitution, where one needs to interpret it and assign a meaning from time to time that aligns with a contextual or a purposive approach. I'm not saying that the department is obviously wrong and that their view is clearly mistaken. I am, however, quite strongly of the view, considering the context and the purpose, that the interpretation is not the correct interpretation. I've discussed this with some of my colleagues that are lawyers, and I'm aware of an interpretation by the NCRP, which I will refer to later, which favors one interpretation. I'm aware, and thanks to the department, they cite an academic study where a different view is expressed. I'm aware of another academic study that expresses another view. And then, of course, we do not have a court case where the court assists us and says, listen, this is the way it should be interpreted. So as we are sitting here, we do our best to interpret it within our skill sets. So then we get to the part. I'll try not to linger on it too much, but just looking at Section 146.6 of the Constitution from an interpretational perspective. Pardon, Jack. Right. I refer here, it's in the footnotes on page 2. The most important rule of interpretation is to establish the purpose of the instrument being interpreted and to give effect to that purpose. In such an exercise, a textual reading is often determinative. Certainly in my case, what the text says, in my experience, what the text says is exactly what it means, but unfortunately that's not always the case. Since the text more often than not also aligns with the purpose of the instrument being interpreted. When one reads the text, however, and it appears as though the plain textual meaning may not or does not align with the purpose of the instrument being interpreted, or as though a plain textual meaning may have more than one meaning, other tools of interpretation become necessary. And of course, this is important. I think it's right. Language is not exact. Maybe particularly lawyers are often aware of that. If language was always exact, there wouldn't be a need for interpretation. I think we all know that one can say something and it's often not, there's not just one obvious meaning that can be assigned to words. I'm on page 3, paragraph 16 of the opinion. I indicated, let's start with the text of the Constitution as a whole, as a point of departure. I think as far as the text of the Constitution is concerned, the legislature's, or my view and the department's view is the same. As far as the content, I mean, of what the Constitution says, maybe not the interpretation of it. Where the Constitution intends to refer to subordinate legislation, in my view, it uses the word subordinate legislation. Section 101(3) of the Constitution, for example, reads, proclamations, regulations, and other instruments of subordinate legislation must be accessible to the public. So it's not as though the Constitution doesn't use the expression subordinate legislation when it wants to say subordinate legislation. Section 239 of the Constitution defines national legislation as inclusive of, I think that's an important word, inclusive of subordinate legislation made in terms of an Act of Parliament. So national legislation inclusive, it is an Act of Parliament including subordinate legislation and proclamations, etc. Nowhere in the Constitution, and this is my view, except and it's the department's view, except in section 146(6) of the Constitution, is subordinate legislation referred to by the expression a law made in terms of an Act of Parliament or a provincial act. Elsewhere in the Constitution, subordinate legislation is referred to as subordinate legislation. In common law, and this principle is also was also followed by the Constitutional Court, in common law, there's a well-known principle to the effect that a legislature is presumed to use language consistently. So when interpreting the meaning of the text, I must presume that it was intended by the Constitutional Assembly in this case to use language consistently. Then I'm on paragraph 22, which begs the question, if the Constitutional Assembly intended for section 146(6) to refer to subordinate legislation only, why did it not use the words subordinate legislation as it had done throughout the Constitution, unless, I'll elaborate this a bit further later on, unless of course it was intended to refer to something other than subordinate legislation. I cite some case law there. I'm not going to refer to all of that in the footnotes. And I mostly just cite that to indicate that there is case law that relates to the points being made and that I'm not sucking it out of my thumb, which is, of course, important. Footnote 9, I make the point, which is maybe related to a point I've already made, but since the expression subordinate legislation is used and has an ascribed meaning in the Constitution, if the Constitutional Assembly intended for section 146(6) to apply only to subordinate legislation, why did it not just say so? I think that's the summary of that point. On paragraphs 23, 24, 25 mostly of the opinion, I deal with the expression in terms of, and I must say I don't want to, I'm not a linguist, I don't think anybody here is, I don't really want to go into a complicated argument as to what the grammatical meaning of in terms of can or cannot be. I have looked at quite a lot of sources though, because the question for me was, and I'll indicate why that was the question a bit later, is the expression in terms of, or a law in terms of, is it capable, reasonably, textually, grammatically capable of a meaning other than the meaning that the department prefers? Because it's good and well to come to a conclusion that from a purposive or a contextual interpretation that a provision should mean a particular thing, but one cannot assign a meaning to a provision which cannot by any reasonable interpretation on the text be the correct interpretation. So one needs to know, is there grammatical meaning that can be attached to the expression other than the grammatical meaning that was preferred by the department? For example, certainly when, I agree, certainly if one reads section 146(6) textually on the face of it, even I would agree that the obvious textual interpretation seems to be the one that the department prefers. However, I'm not of the view that that is the only reasonable interpretation, and for reasons which we will discuss a bit later, I think it's in the context of the Constitution, it is quite clear that that is not the meaning that should be assigned to that expression. In paragraph 27, I indicate if a contextual and purposive interpretation of the Constitution yields a conclusion that is not the correct construction of the meaning of this expression in section 146(6) of the Constitution. That sounds wrong. And should there be a different acceptable meaning that aligns with the contextual and purposive approach, that different meaning must be accepted. Then the footnotes at point 11, I refer to some case law. Maybe I'll just read the second case there, Doctors for Life, paragraph 18, where the court follows a similar principle. Where there are provisions in the Constitution that appear to conflict with each other, the proper approach is to examine them to ascertain whether they can reasonably be reconciled. And they must be construed in a manner that gives full effect to each. Provisions in the Constitution should not be construed in a manner that results in them being in conflict with each other. Rather, they should be construed in a manner that harmonizes them. Then I'm at paragraph 28 of the opinion. I think here maybe we get more to the flesh and not the grammar and the linguistics and all those kind of things. There are three reasons why I argue that the interpretation of section 146(6), which is preferred in the department's opinion, cannot be the correct interpretation. I'm going to elaborate them significantly, but just as a point of departure to sort of get our heads into it. The first reason is that the interpretation in the department's opinion results in conflict with the text of the Constitution itself, and that conflict can be resolved by a different interpretation, and then maybe we can refer back to the Doctors for Life principle that I've just read. The second reason is that the interpretation in the department's opinion does not resolve conflicts of laws. I must say I'm actually a bit concerned about that, but as I said, I'll elaborate that on a bit further. Short of approaching the courts, by which I mean, so should the national sphere of government and the provincial sphere of government not come to some sort of an understanding on a conflict, should there be a conflict, the only way of dealing with that issue would be to approach the courts. I think everybody here is aware of the proliferation of instances where the courts are approached to deal with issues which, and arguably in this case, which should be dealt with the legislatures. And in my view, this is one of those cases. Because on the department's view, should there be a disagreement between the national sphere and the provincial sphere on a law, then the only way that disagreement can be resolved would be for the courts to become involved. I'm not persuaded that that was the intention. The second reason is that the interpretation in the department's opinion does not resolve conflicts of law, as I said, but allows the national and provincial spheres of government to assert, respectively, that their law prevails on the basis of their own view of how the Constitution should be interpreted. I'm not of the view that this is what the Constitution intends. I'm of the view that it is much more likely that the Constitution intends to create processes and mechanisms whereby conflicts of laws can be definitively resolved, resulting in legal certainty. And then the third, and I'm going to raise this point last, and the third, and in my view, most important reason, is that the interpretation in the department's opinion is irrational, maybe that's or illogical, or it doesn't make sense, to put it that way, and does not correlate meaningfully to the interrelation between original legislation and subordinate legislation. Then I make some comments on the first reason. It is trite, everybody agrees it seems, that the expression national legislation where it occurs in the Constitution includes subordinate legislation made in terms of an act of parliament or a provincial act. So where the Constitution refers to national legislation, we've established that, it's in section 239 of the Constitution. It refers to acts of parliament, provincial acts, and subordinate legislation. In the department's opinion, as we said, the views expressed that section 146(6) of the Constitution is intended to apply to subordinate legislation only on an interpretation of section 146(6). as we know, Section 146(6) of the Constitution creates a requirement for the approval of laws by the National Council of Provinces for those laws to prevail over others. I make a comment here, and I think it's an important comment in the footnotes, when the Constitution refers to approval by a legislature, it is not talking about the lawmaking process. When the NCOP is making a law, or provincial legislature is making a law, or Parliament, the National Assembly is making a law, the Constitution, as far as I could ascertain, always refers to you pass a law with amendments, etc. So when the Constitution uses the word approval in relation to legislatures, and it does in many instances, it refers to decisions and powers that the legislatures have, which is not part of the lawmaking process. So is it the National Assembly? Let me read that. For example, the NCOP may disapprove a Section 100 intervention. So it's not making a law, but it's got the power to make a decision, and that decision is a disapproval. The National Assembly may approve to recommend a person for appointment by the President as public protector. Section 193 of the Constitution. Or Parliament may approve a state of national defense. Section 203 of the Constitution. So where the Constitution uses the word approval by a legislature or the NCOP in this case, we're not talking about lawmaking. We're not talking about the NCOP making a law. It's some other sort of decision or power that the NCOP can exercise. And this is where, and I'm not the only one, that where Section 146(4) of the Constitution throws a bit of a spanner in the works. Section 146(4) of the Constitution provides that when there is a dispute concerning whether national legislation, and we've already established what national legislation means in the Constitution, an act of Parliament, a provincial act, or and subordinate legislation, is necessary for a purpose set out in subsection 2C of the Constitution, and that dispute comes before a court for resolution, the court must have due regard to the approval or the rejection of the legislation by the National Council of Provinces. So here we can only be referring to Section 146(6). And I raise the issue of what approval means in the Constitution because I would not agree with an argument that says no, but that section refers to a law that was passed by the NCOP as part of a lawmaking process. That's not, in my view, what the Constitution refers to here. The section is important because it presupposes that by the time national legislation comes before a court, it presupposes that there would have been an approval or a rejection of the legislation, not the subordinate, the legislation, by the National Council of Provinces. Reading that, I cannot help but come to the conclusion that the approval in Section 146(6) of the Constitution referred to there cannot possibly only relate to subordinate legislation because Section 146(4) says something quite different. I'll make the point there. I've read a... Let me just get the reference. Okay, I'll refer to that a bit later. At paragraph 32.6. Now, for the interpretation advanced in the department's opinion to be accepted, it must also be accepted that the Constitutional Assembly used both the expression, a law in terms of an act of Parliament or a provincial act, as in 146(6), and the expressions national legislation and legislation to in fact mean subordinate legislation. This in spite of the fact that the Constitution itself appears to use the expression subordinate legislation when it in fact intends to refer to subordinate legislation, and that the Constitution itself defines legislation as inclusive of original legislation and subordinate legislation. As I pointed out, so that's where, on my reading, we are sitting with a conflict of meaning between Section 146(4) and 146(6) of the Constitution, and the question is, we have textual interpretations, but contextually and purposively, how can this conflict be dealt with? Is there a way that Section 146(6) can be interpreted so that it does not conflict with the rest of the Constitution? As I've indicated, it's presupposed by Section 146(4) that at least certain types of legislation, including original legislation, must be subjected to the approval or rejection of the National Council of Provinces in terms of Section 146(4) of the Constitution. I'm sure that most lawyers will agree with me, even if that is the case, the exact 146.4 itself is not very clear and is also likely to cause some confusion. It can not be said that Section 146.6 is intended to apply to subordinate legislation on this basis. And here I refer to footnote 20 on page 6. This also appears to be the view in a National Council of Provinces document titled Interim Report of Joint Subcommittee on Delegated Legislation on Scrutiny of Legislation. That's quite an old document, but then of course it was in 2002, so that document related to the Constitution as it already was at the time. In that document, and this is a discussion document, it was a discussion document in the NCOB. They engaged with Section 146.6, and the NCOB also tried to get some clarity on what does it mean and what does it mean for the NCOB. And they indicate there is a narrow interpretation. The narrow interpretation in that report is the same as the department's interpretation, which is 146.6 only refers to subordinate legislation. But then they also discuss Section 146.4, and it appears to suggest that there's certainly some national legislation that also needs to be referred to in terms of Section 146.6 of the Constitution. But there was no definitive decision there. To my knowledge, the NCOB still has made no definitive decision on how Section 146.6 matters should be dealt with. That is probably because of the questions and uncertainties that we are discussing here as well. Then on the second reason, I spoke about this briefly, and maybe this is more from a legislative policy perspective. The interpretation in the department's opinion does not resolve conflicts of laws short of approaching courts, as I've already said, but allows national and provincial spheres of government to assert respectively that their law prevails on the basis of their own views of how the Constitution should be interpreted. And that's why I was hesitant. First, I didn't have enough information. But I was hesitant to engage with subsections 2 and 3 and to make an argument that the provincial act should or shouldn't prevail. As I'm sitting here, I'm of the view that it probably should prevail. But that's not an opinion, that's just an extemporary view. Because if the interpretation of 146.6 is not accepted, we are going to sit with situations where a provincial government, not necessarily this one, a provincial government, strongly feel that on their reading and their interpretation of subsections 2 and 3, their provincial law should prevail. And then we will have a national government that similarly strongly, and they will also have the attorneys and advocates and people making the same argument, arguing that no, subsections 2 and 3 does apply, and therefore the national act should prevail. Whether I agree, I've read some of the comments by what comes to mind now is Equal Education at one of the unions. I can't remember which one. I think it was Nectos. I mean, there we have lawyers making arguments. Whether one agrees with them or not is besides the point for now, but they argue strongly that subsections 2 and 3 should apply. So we are set with a position where if Section 146.6 is interpreted as the department proposes, then all these disputes will have to be determined by the courts. I'm not of the view that it's likely that this is what the Constitution intends. I'm of the view that it's much more likely that the Constitution intended to create processes and mechanisms whereby conflicts of laws can be definitively resolved, resulting in legal certainty. Of course, from that process, there may be disputes. An NCOB may make a decision, as happens now, and a stakeholder may not be happy with that decision, but then that decision can be challenged. But then at least an attempt is made for the lawmaking bodies of the Republic to deal with the issue before the courts are drawn in. I'm on paragraph 33.3. Should there be a conflict or conflicts between national laws and provincial laws, to me, the National Council of Provinces appears as the obvious institution to decide questions of prevalence. This is so because, constitutionally, the National Council of Provinces, as we all know, exists at the intersection of national and provincial interests. This makes the National Council of Provinces the obvious forum for issues of conflict between provincial and national interests to be debated and decided from a legislative policy perspective before approaching the courts. Of course, once the National Council of Provinces approves or refuses to approve a certain law in terms of Section 146.6, an interested party may raise the issue for determination by the courts. And again, here Section 146.6 comes to mind because that appears to be what is intended. Where I say that 146.6 appears to presuppose that by the time these issues will get to the court, there would have been a decision by the NCOP that the court must take into consideration when it makes its decision. Then on the third reason, paragraph 34.1, I argue, not only is it illogical to suggest that only subordinate legislation must be referred for approval by the National Council of Provinces, but it is also illogical to suggest that the issue of prevalence of subordinate legislation is likely to arise at all. And here, I must just make some careful statements to just sort of build that argument properly. One must remember as a point of departure that all subordinate legislation and its legal authority to bind emanates from original legislation. I think we all know that subordinate legislation or a set of regulations cannot do something that is not that is outside of the scope of what the empowering law provides for. Once a minister or an MEC makes a set of regulations which goes outside of the scope of what the provincial law empowers the MEC or minister to do, then we're not dealing with prevalence even, then we're talking about old principles, whether the minister acted ultra vires, and whether the set of regulations is outside of the scope of the rule of law. The minister is doing something that the law is not empowering the minister to do. Subordinate legislation that purports to bind outside of the scope of the original or empowering law is unlawful. A subordinate law cannot do a thing or impart a right or obligation outside of the scope of the original or empowering law. And I think it is important to appreciate that fact. So the purpose of subordinate legislation, one, a legislature passes a law, and the legislature in effect says, this is the legislative policies and principles which we've now encapsulated as a law. And in order to implement that, we give an executive certain powers to implement that. So the purpose of the subordinate legislation is to give effect to what the provincial or the national act provides for. It cannot go outside of the scope of that. Right. I'm at paragraph 34.3. Let us assume that, in a particular set of circumstances, a provincial act prevails over an act of parliament. And we're not even talking now about how it prevails and who's... Let's just assume, for the sake of argument, it's a fact. This provincial act prevails over the national act. Now, in terms of the provincial act, subordinate legislation is made. So the provincial act says, this is the law, this is what must be achieved. And in order to achieve that, the executive can make subordinate legislation to give effect to this. Let us assume that the subordinate legislation was made lawfully and that it's within the scope of what the provincial act empowers. Let us assume further that there is subordinate legislation in terms of the Act of Parliament, but we've now established that on whatever basis this Act of Parliament does not prevail, the Provincial Act prevails. It is my argument that it could not have been intended for the National Council of Provinces to have a discretion to decide that subordinate legislation properly made in terms of a provincial act that prevails over a national act should not apply, but that the regulations in terms of the Act of Parliament that does not prevail should apply. That to me would just seem inherently irrational. So the Constitution would give a power to a legislature to make a law on an area, schools or health or whatever, and the province can make that law, and that law can prevail over a national act, but then we tell the province, you cannot implement the law. because the NCAP can make a decision that the subordinate legislation in terms of that law should not prevail. But I fail to see how that could reasonably have been the intention of the Constitutional Assembly. I'm at 34.7. The point being simply the following, that there's little or absolutely no point to referring subordinate legislation to the National Council of Provinces for a decision on whether it should prevail. The application or otherwise of subordinate legislation where there are conflicts is necessarily decided by a determination of whether an Act of Parliament or a Provincial Act prevails. So once we know whether an Act of Parliament or a Provincial Act prevails, it must be that the subordinate legislation that can be lawfully made in terms of that Act must be given effect to. Otherwise we're sitting with laws that are lawful but which can't be implemented. In this context, it makes no sense to suggest that Section 146.6 is intended only for conflicts between sets of subordinate legislation. Maybe I don't need to make the argument that I think that subordinate legislation will probably never go to the NCOB in terms of, I can't really see, but I'll stick to the point that it can't only be subordinate legislation that is intended by 146.6. Quick concluding remarks, in my view, the view in the Department's opinion that Section 146.6 of the Constitution only refers to approval by the National Council of Provinces of subordinate legislation is only textually persuasive. I can maybe just make another example. I see a footnote 24 on page 8, just quickly. There are other examples demonstrating the inherent irrationality of suggesting that Section 146 applies only to subordinate legislation. Just another example. So if we get to a point where we apply 146.6, what kind of difficulties might we run into? Let's say, for example, that we have a provincial act that does not conflict with an Act of Parliament in the same functional area. So there's no conflicts between the Provincial Act and the National Act. But a conflict arises between the sets of subordinate legislation governing these acts. If the acts do not conflict, such a conflict between the sets of subordinate legislation can only arise if the one or the other set of subordinate legislation exceeds the limits of what it is empowered in terms of its original or empowering law. But if that is the case, we're not dealing with a conflict of subordinate legislation, then the courts need to determine which minister has exceeded the bounds of his powers when the subordinate legislation was made. On top of page 9, paragraph 35.2, in my view, a contextual and purposive approach suggests that section 146.6 was intended by the Constitutional Assembly to refer to Acts of Parliament and Provincial Acts for all of the reasons that mentioned. It is conceded from an interpretational perspective that section 146 of the Constitution is not well drafted. I know that every lawyer I've spoken to on section 146.6 would agree with this. This section will benefit from constitutional review so that its intention is more clearly expressed, so that we don't have to go through these exercises of trying to construe what it means and what it intends. Chair, I make a suggestion there, and this is maybe something that the committee may consider. Of course, amending the Constitution is not in the mandate of this legislature, but what this legislature can do in terms of Section 104.5 of the Constitution is maybe to recommend to the National Assembly that Section 146 needs a review, since we are in a process of looking at how the Constitution can be change or improve. Chair, on points B and C, I will be significantly shorter. On point B, conflicts in respect of collaboration schools and donor-funded public schools. I don't go into all the details of the submissions in the department's opinion. Paragraph 37, I say it's common cause between the department's opinion and the legislature's opinion that provincial acts on Schedule 4 matters will generally prevail over acts of Parliament, and that there's no need to argue that which is agreed on. importantly, I think, on paragraph 38, to the extent that it is argued in the department's opinion that there is no conflict between the National Act and the Provincial Act, I am persuaded. I agree with the department for the reasons stated in the department's opinion. I think the department there just made the point, which is a good point, that the intention in SASSA as it relates to the governing bodies is not as clearly expressed as my initial assessment was, and I think the department is correct. Of course, on paragraph 39, this is a legal opinion. The committee's got the difficult job of deciding whether from a policy perspective that is a good or a bad idea, but that's not for me to comment on. Then similarly, on at part C, conflicts in respect of the sale and consumption of alcohol in public schools. I don't need to go into all the detail in the department's opinion. Paragraph 42, to the extent that it is argued in the department's opinion that there is no conflict between the regulations in terms of the National Act and the Provincial Bill, I am persuaded. I agree with the department there as well. Maybe on footnote 32, I'm persuaded by the department's argument that the relevant provisions as an exception to the position in the regulations can coexist without conflict. I think especially in my thinking on this issue, I was particularly concerned initially about the intention expressed in the regulations and the intention expressed in the provincial bill from a legal interpretational perspective. And it seemed to me as though those intentions could not be reconciled, as though the regulations clearly express one intention and the provincial bill expresses another intention. I think maybe on further reflection, especially if one looks at mischief, the old mischief rule, why is there a regulation, why is there a provincial bill? Certainly, and the committee, and from a policy perspective, there can be lots of conversations about what is desirable, etc. I'm not going there, that's not for me to comment on. But I don't think it can be said, I think it's fair to say that the mischief that the regulations seek to address and the mischief that the provincial bill seeks to address in this context, it's the same mischief, which is to create safe and secure schools, but it's a different expression of how to achieve that. The how to achieve that and whether it's the best way to achieve that, that the committee can debate and decide. On part D, unfortunately, yeah, I will have to say quite a bit again. Delegation of subordinate lawmaking powers and intervention facilities. Here I need to revert to my initial opinion or the legislature's opinion to rely on what I said there. I'm not persuaded by the arguments in the department's opinion to the effect that the subordinate lawmaking power imparted by the bill in respect of intervention facilities is not an unlawful delegation of plenary lawmaking power. I see that the legislature's opinion and the department's opinion in large part cross-reference and refer to the same case law. Of course, came to different conclusions, but then we can rely on that set of case law. Chair, just give me a minute to catch my breath. Chair, also here, I think this is an important issue. In fact, earlier this year, I made an identical, virtually identical submission.
Mr. Miller, do you have some water in front?
I do, Chair. Thank you, Chair. Earlier this year, I've made a similar submission in respect of the different bill. I think some of the members here were also on that committee. And Chair, I'm also of the view that this is an important issue, which is the to what extent can a legislature delegate lawmaking authorities to an executive authority? And I think everybody here knows that can be done. Where does one draw the line between what can be lawfully delegated and what cannot be lawfully delegated? And Chair, I'm referring here to paragraph 34 of the legislature's opinion, which is the first opinion. I say the comments here are concerned with the establishment of intervention facilities, paragraph 35. even though the provisions here are likely to have a significant effect on the best interests of children that become subject to its arrangements, the provisions are skeletal and grants the provincial minister very broad, in my view, lawmaking power, which power in turn is not delimited by the bill. We need to refer to some case law in paragraph 36. I referred to Executive Council of the Western Cape and others, which is fully cited there. And I also refer here in the footnotes to section 28.2 of the Constitution, which I'm sure everybody knows, a child's best interests are of paramount importance in every matter concerning the child. So when making a law, a legislature such as this one would want to do some checks and balances and make sure that provisions that will impact on children is acceptable to the legislature. Paragraph 37, let me start at 38. The court found, I'm not going to read all the authority there, but it says in short that it is a fact that legislatures can delegate subordinate lawmaking powers to executives. That is not contentious. There is, however, the court said, a difference between delegating authority to make subordinate legislation within the framework of a statute, and I want to emphasize those words, within the framework of a statute, not a policy document somewhere, within the framework of a statute under which the delegation is made, and assigning plenary legislative power to another body. And then the question the court there had to make a call on whether in that instance they were dealing with a delegation of subordinate lawmaking power, which is lawful, or whether they were dealing with a delegation of the legislature's power to make laws, which is not lawful. Paragraph 39. Hence, in principle, there's no objection to delegating the authority to make subordinate legislation to another body. Note, however, the condition that such a delegation must be within the framework of a statute. There's a line to be drawn between making a law and making subordinate laws within the framework of a law. In paragraph 53 of Executive Council, the court found inspiration from the law of the United States of America. I'm here on paragraph 40. The true distinction, therefore, is between the delegation of power to make the law, which necessarily involves a discretion as to what it shall be, and conferring the authority or discretion as to its execution, to be exercised under and in pursuance of a law. The first cannot be done. To the latter, no valid objection can be made. I make the comment there in footnote 17 on page 7 of the first opinion, but it's not always easy to draw the line between an acceptable delegation of lawmaking power and a delegation that is not acceptable. Much depends on the context and the purpose of the delegation. I think the legislature's opinion and the department's opinion is in agreement on that. One must look at the whole context. But that the principles here nevertheless apply. So it's not always black and white, but one should be able to draw the distinction by just applying the broad principles. In paragraph 54 of Executive Council, the judgment, the court pointed out that Ireland had adopted a similar approach to the one of the United States of America and states, in paraphrase, my paraphrase, that whether one is looking at an unlawful delegation of parliamentary power as opposed to a lawful delegation of regulatory power depends on whether more than the mere giving effect to of principles and policies in the statute is delegated. So the policies and the principles needs to be in the law. The implementation of how those principles and policies is given effect to practically and operationally can be delegated. On paragraph 42, hence the legislature must determine the policies and principles of what the law is, where is the regulatory details of implementation of those policies and principles may be delegated to an executive. At paragraph 43, a comment by by Mohammed where the judge said, first concern is that since the Constitution reposes confidence in the political judgment of those elected to Congress and their capacity to make policies pursuant to that judgment, it would be constitutionally subversive to allow such political judgment and such policies effectively to be made by those not identified for that purpose in the Constitution. I'm referring here to paragraph 5, where Judge Sachs commented, "The Constitution contains no express limitation on the power of Parliament to pass a law delegating its legislative authority. If we look at the design and structure of the Constitution as a whole, however, I have no doubt that such a limit must be implied. Indeed, it flows from the very majesty of Parliament and not from its impotence. Certain tasks are entrusted to it and to it alone. Parliament has not only extensive powers but heavy responsibilities. Under our Constitution, it is the centerpiece of the whole government structure." At footnote 20 there, on page 8, I make the comment, "Laws are intended to be made by elected public office bearers meeting in legislatures and councils," and I will get back to that point a bit later, "not by officials and executive authorities of government departments who are tasked with the implementation of laws." Very important, in paragraph 46, where I quote Judge Sachs, and I think this is an important thing to take account of, because it's one of the reasons why it's incredibly important that legislative policy decisions should be made by legislatures and not elsewhere. And I'll read that quote. "The reason why," and this is what Sachs J says, "full legislative authority is entrusted to Parliament and Parliament alone, would seem to be that the procedures for open debate, subject to ongoing press and public criticism, the visibility of the decision-making process, the involvement of civil society in relation to committee hearings, and the pluralistic interaction between different viewpoints which parliamentary procedures promotes are regarded as essential features of the open and democratic society contemplated in the Constitution," making the point that laws must be made by legislatures and not by executives. I underline this part. "It is Parliament's function and responsibility to deal with the broad and controversial questions of legislative policy according to these processes. It is not its duty to attend to all the details of implementation. At the same time, if it is not to fail to discharge the functions entrusted to it by the Constitution, there must be some limit on the matters which it can delegate." If I look at the intervention facilities and I look at it at the context of the fact that it's a provision, just briefly summarized, providing the provincial executive can create intervention facilities and children that have seriously misconducted themselves can be referred to those intervention facilities for therapeutic programs and education. That's more or less the gist of it. It appears to me as though there's a whole space of policy questions that a committee would want answers to on how that will be implemented and what the policy objectives of that is. I'll refer a bit later to the Children's Act maybe to make that point a bit clearer. I make the point of paragraph 47, "It is intended for lawmaking to be a public process, especially in as much as the basic policies and principles underpinning a law is concerned. The Constitution does not intend that legislatures give mandates to others to develop and refine the policies and principles underpinning a law in a manner removed from public oversight and public involvement." Further, in paragraph 206 of Executive Council, Judge Sachs mentioned certain considerations one may include in deciding whether delegated lawmaking power is acceptable. I think some of these are also cited in the department's opinion. These factors include whether the discretion of the delegatee is properly structured and guided by the enabling law, as well as the public importance and constitutional significance of the matter. In paragraph 49 of the opinion, I quote Sachs J, "One of his fundamental objections to the delegated lawmaking power in that case was the glaring fact that Section 16A provides no clear guidelines as to how the President is to exercise his legislative powers. So the President was given a power, but there was no indication in the Act. You must take account of the following, you can do this, you cannot do that. Some sort of limitation on how the President should exercise that power. Page 9, footnote 23, I make the comment, it is not intended that laws be made without the openness and process requirements or the manner and form requirements, as Judge Sachs called it, typical to legislatures. This is what Judge Sachs said, not me. There's a fundamental risk of tyranny in the delegation of plenary lawmaking power, by which it was meant laws being made by executive authorities and not by legislatures, which, as we all know, was how things was done at some points in the past. Once a legislature determined whether and how to limit the right, and I think that's an important point, that is fundamentally where the legislature should. So the implementation of the thing, that can be delegated. But when we're talking about limiting the constitutional rights of children, which is this, in my view, that conversation is a good example of a conversation that should be made in a legislature and decisions that should be made in a legislature. Once the legislature determined whether and how to limit the right, the operational implementational details of that determination can be left to executives and their officials. Chair, at this point, just to make an example, I just quickly want to refer to Chapter 13 of the Children's Act. It's not identical to the intention that is expressed by the provincial department, but I refer to it as an example of how, in the Children's Act, how the legislature was involved with the broad issues of policy, and then after that, the implementational details was delegated to officials. And I'm going to run through it quickly, even though it spans quite a few pages. Chapter 13 relates to child and youth care centres. And in Section 191, there is the legislative policies is set out of what a child and youth care centre is, and the size of it, what a child and youth care centre is intended to do, importantly, what a child and youth care centre is not, as far as it also provides for therapeutic programs. It indicates what kind of programs those may be and what it is not. It refers to the fact that a child and youth care centre may provide for residential care. It elaborates on what that may entail. And then it empowers certain, gives certain powers to the provincial head of social development to make certain. And it refers to a strategy to ensure sufficient provision of child and youth care centres and how that should be done. And then also it provides for national norms and standards, which I think there's a similar provision in this law. But important here is that it gives some, I'm referring to Section 194, it gives some framework for what the national norms and standards must relate. It's not an open discretion, it's a focused discretion. It deals with existing government children's homes and how that should be dealt with. I think if one goes further, it also, importantly also, it deals with, from a legislative policy perspective, how should child and youth care centres be managed, who should be in charge of them, how does the legislature have oversight of what's going on there, etc., etc. Point I'm trying to make. In my view, that is a good example of making the distinction between of a space where a legislature makes legislative policy decisions, and once those decisions are fleshed out, once the law clearly communicates what is intended, how should the rights of children be limited in this case, etc., then the implementation of that is delegated. All the little details of how that should be achieved is then delegated. I'm not persuaded by the department's opinion that I remain of the view that the provisions in the bill is very skeletal, considering that this legislature is asked to make a decision on that is likely to impact on the best interests of children, and that it in effect allows the provincial minister to create a system of intervention facilities and make a whole range of decisions around that, which this legislature is that does not have an input on. And this legislature is, in my view, simply asked to give a broad power to the minister to decide how that should be done and what the policy position would be. There should be some constraints in the bill as far as these provisions are concerned. Actually, I'm quite out of breath now, but I think I'll...
Thank you very much, Advocate André Leroux. I'm not surprised that you're out of breath. Thanks very much for an exhaustive opinion and also response to the WCED. It's highly appreciated. And well done, and I'll give over to the members now if they have to want to pose any questions or if there's a need. Member Mitchell?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you to Advocate Leroux for taking us through. I'm not going to take us through each line, but I just want to, just for clarity, for interest sake and clarity, you quoted a judgment or an extract from a judgment with regards to the executive not making or introducing law. I just want to check where you got that, because according to me, the bill process allows for a member of the executive, member of MPL, even a standing committee to introduce a bill before it becomes an act. So I just want to understand that context. And then, Chair, with regards to a statement made that this bill, when it becomes an act, will give the executive authority too much power, or that's the word that in the paper, extended power. I can't even know the English word. But see there, a broad scope. What is? And I need to choose my words carefully because I don't want to be misquoted. But isn't the relevant executive authority the custodian for education in this case? So I'm going to ask, so what? With respect, we must, and this is just a side note, that when we make laws, we must and debate these things. Take the individual out of the equation, and we must look at what's in front of us. So that's just clarity on that.
Thank you so much for the intriguing question.
Chair, just quickly on the. I think the point is simply, the executive has their powers. Constitutionally, their powers is to implement the law, not to make the law. Those powers are often extensive. But yes, just simply that is where the distinction should be drawn. I apologize to the member. The first question was, I didn't quite, maybe you can just repeat that.
Okay. I understood by what has been quoted as case law, that the intention, according to the law, was not for the executive to introduce law, but the bill process allows for a member of the executive, member of parliament, MPL, or even a standing committee to in fact do that, and or make laws or a bill, and it in actual fact get introduced by the speaker. So I'm not disputing the process or the constitutional process of it, but you made that comment. So I just wanted to understand where that fits in. And again, on the response, the executive, according to my view, and I'm no legal expert yet, the executive can do it, can introduce, and that's the point.
You remember, Michel? Clear?
I can't remember. Maybe this, I used the words introduce and make incorrectly at some point, I don't know. But of course, a law may be introduced by a provincial minister or by a member or by a committee. And the point I was probably making is, of course, there's a difference between introducing a law and making a law. But yes, a law can be introduced by, and it almost always is introduced by the executive, but then should be made by the legislature.
Do you sure respond to member? I'm sorry, member, will you feel? No problem.
No, Chair, let me first from the onset indicate I'm not a legal fundi. I've never went to that route. So mind my ignorance. Chair, I'm sitting here and I just for my own clarity from our legal advisor there. From whatever he said, or from the latter part of what he presented to us, is that there seems to be a difference of opinion in terms of the interpretation of section 146, whatever, whether it's 146, 6, and so on. And he also mentioned it, for me, I just want to be 100% sure. Now, if there are those difference of opinions, the advice basically is that a different forum, whether it's the courts or NCOP, whoever it is, should be the body that is the final arbiter to that differences of opinion. And I want, before I move too far, just to first get that understanding, whether that's what I do understand, that section, there's a difference of opinion between ourselves, our opinion as the legislature and that of the department, particularly with reference to the subordinate introduction of the bill. That's what the department feels, and you have got a different opinion to that one. And I want you to clarify that for me before I get a different type of understanding. So the interpretation thereof is seemingly is the disputing factor between the two of you, and you also further said that you forstand. What is forstand in English? You stand by that, yeah, by that opinion. So I just want to be quite sure, because then this body ultimately has to make some sort of a decision. Then I want to go to another point that Chair, I want a bit of clarity on. And I see in this, what is this, the 11th September, 29, page 5, the top one there. Okay, that's what I've now asked. That's what we are referring to. But that interpretation, that difference of interpretation must be dealt with by a different text, that the conflict can be resolved by a different interpretation. Now that different interpretation will assist me. Who else must then do that? Because if there are those differences between the two, if I can get clarity on that before I ask many other issues.
Thank you, Member.
Chair, on that, yes, so there are different interpretations. I have an interpretation, the department's got an interpretation. As I indicated, the NCMP has got an interpretation. There's an academic authority cited by the department where an interpretation, and then I'm aware of another academic authority that views the matter differently. So it's a problem. So all we can do is we can interpret it as we are sitting here as well as we can and argue that the one or the other is the most likely correct interpretation. I would, personally, maybe that's not the right word, I would very much think that the ideal place for this to be resolved is by the National Assembly and by Parliament. Because I think even, I mean, it's clear that even the NCOP, when they were sitting with these issues, were not quite sure how to interpret it. Is it a narrow interpretation? Or but then if it is, then how does Section 146.4 come into play? I mean, even the NCOP seem to have been a bit baffled by it. So I really do think that this legislature can recommend that Parliament look at Section 146.6. The only alternative, I think, is that it will be decided by the courts. But as I've mentioned already, I think it would be better if Parliament can deal with it.
Thank you, Advocate. Member McKenzie.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, we've obviously received the previous for the legal opinion from the advocate 3 weeks back, and we received the one from the department, and we received the advocates now during the session. Can I make a recommendation going forward? Because obviously there's in law there are different interpretations and there are different opinions. Can we as members or as individuals or as a committee reconvene with whatever our views are and our opinions is going forward? Because like in any law there's different opinions, different interpretations. That we do to come back, just I'm just trying to provide a way forward, because I've got many notes and many interpretations, but it's not going to solve it. I'm not going to solve it now. Just on a way forward, because time is not on our side. So the recommend that we come back to the, because there is a meeting scheduled next week to finalize some of these matters in any case. So just want to recommend on the way forward, because I would like to go back and just relook at some of the what the department said and relook at what the advocate said this morning, just for my own interpretation, so we can finalize at least these legal opinions by the end of next week.
Thank you, Member McKenzie. I'm looking to my right, Advocate Sir.
It's Ms. Thor. I'm not an advocate such as my colleague, but thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, Chair, and thank you to my colleague, Advocate LaRue. Chair, as you are aware, we only received this opinion this morning, but I have had an opportunity to have a look at it now and listen to my colleague. We would like an opportunity to do a short response, but can I just make a few points at this stage? Would that be all right? Thank you, Chair.
Before that input is made, maybe we should, I've got a view, maybe we should just ascertain what Member McKenzie is now raising. Whether that otherwise is now withdrawn from that recommendation, then we can then continue. But I think there was a recommendation that maybe we should reconvene and allow the opportunity then, unless he has got a different. Because I wanted to give input to that one, and maybe further look at that.
Yes, Chair. I mean, it's also, and even now that I have the department only saw this now, it's even more pertinent that I do get what their final or their second bite is. And I know you're going to make input in Section 146, but I might have a question or two on that. We're going to sit here for 2-3 hours. Hence, I would appreciate if you can, having received the input, give us a one-pager, and we then as a committee need to make a decision as to our interpretation of what we think, at least from my perspective, what I would think of my opinion is, because at the end of the day, we are lawmakers, and we have to take responsibility for whatever law we make or not make. So I think if the department gets a fair and just opportunity, that they've now listened to the last hour and 20 minutes, give them another 1 or 2 days just to give us feedback, and then we as a committee get that and we make our own decisions on to the way forward, because at the end of the day, as you quoted Judge Sachs and I've read the judgment, the buck stops with us.
Are you satisfied with this?
Chair, I just have one point, and it seems to me that we may be entering into an unnecessary academic debate here. And can I just give my reasons for saying that, and Advocate LaRue may agree with me. Advocate LaRue concedes the point that he's persuaded by the department's view that there does not seem to be a conflict in respect of the provisions on the collaboration schools, the donor-funded schools, and the alcohol provision. That being the case, Section 146 only kicks in the event that there is a conflict. So, for example, the test as to whether national or provincial legislation prevails only applies if there is a conflict. And equally, 146.6 only comes into play if there is a conflict. The issue of what prevails and what doesn't prevail doesn't actually apply at all. So it seems to me that we may be entering into an academic debate. I remain convinced that the Constitution is clear that the court provides, the Constitution is clear that the courts are the final arbiters of whether national legislation or provincial legislation prevails. But I won't elaborate now on this forum. It's just an issue of whether we in fact need to enter into this debate at all.
Sorry, Shed, not to get the dialogue now, exactly what you said. You know, one email would deal with that, and we as the committee will then go back and come back for further deliberations on this next week.
I think it's important that you raise that point, Mr. And I think it stands separately and very distinctly. You mentioned it, and I was just scared that it might get lost in that broader scope that you envisage in terms of going forward. But that should be illuminated and highlighted in terms of a very specific and focused point in terms of the academic baggage that it carries. But in any case, thank you so much for that. Mr. Coleridge.
Thank you, Chairperson. The only point that I can see Advocate LaRue is making as well is in terms of intervention facilities, where he believes that we need a little bit more material and substance and form. And I think as a department, we've discussed that. The fact that he's conceded the provincial competency for collaboration schools, donor-funded schools, alcohol and premises makes our job quite easier in terms of debates going forward. So there are concessions, and we can also discuss as the legal representatives the substance and form of intervention facilities. And so that is just our position. And the regulations that will go with that. And then, Chair, just as a last point, Member Boerta was acting chairperson on the 28th of August, and she also requested us to submit written submissions on the implementation of the pilot project on the evaluation of schools. So we actually have the written submission just for completeness, and under Member Boerta's instructions. Due to time constraints, we had limited time, and so therefore we made written submissions. And we've got copies for all the members as well, which is over there, and we can hand it so that we can actually wrap up that last session as well in relation to the request.
We accept it with appreciation. Thank you very much for that. Member Olivier, I think Member Olivier, then I'll take Member Dagmar. Member Boerta, then Member Dagmar.
Chair, I just wanted to know, in terms of Advocate Coleridge, is she suggesting that the department will actually formulate an amendment on the issue of the intervention facilities? And will that then be provided to the committee at what stage?
We concede the point that we believe the point made by Advocate LaRue is that when the learners are at the intervention facilities, they must receive the same quality and standard of education that they would have received. And I think we can give more clarity in the amended version of that bill. However, the strategies and therapeutic programs, we can't concede on that, and I think Dr. Nyker will concur with us that each situation is different, our learners have difference, and we will apply different therapeutic programs depending on the circumstances. So for us to legislate on specific details, for instance, substance abuse or anger management, it's that going to go into the minutiae, which we don't believe is appropriate for the bill.
There you go. Member Boerta. Member Buerta?
No, no, Member Buerta.
Are you sure? No. He will come back. Member McKenzie?
No, no, I just want to say to Advocate LaRue, it's like probably the most important part of this process, and talked about it, was raised in another committee, was the changing of the constitution, or the recommendation. I mean, if you ever wanted to be famous, that will make you world famous. Because the NCOP post-2019, and not only getting the politics, I think is going to become very powerful, and they are going to have significant impact on provinces, so that will be...
Member Buerta,
no,
she found
the... I'm using semantics now.
You're
I'm
welcome.
Coming back to my point that advocates don't use, and I think it was a request and not an instruction.
Good. Thank you, Member Buerta. Member Naike?
thank you, Chairperson. You know, the children who go to the intervention center, they are very, the challenges are quite unique. So, you know, you can't prescribe. It's like saying to a medical doctor before the day, give me all the prescriptions that you're going to suggest for the day. You can't do that. You know, the children are unique and they present very challenging it's quite a challenge to address the difficulties, and their behavior is actually quite complex, you know. So I think that I think we have provided enough information on the intervention center, and I think I think those children really need an intervention, and you've got to acknowledge that it is a quality intervention, because it's very rare for children to get exposed to a social worker, to an occupational therapist, to a psychologist, and it's quite an expensive service.
Thank you, Dr. Naiker. Dr. Advocate LaRue, I saw your hand up, and then Ms. McLaughlin up. Advocate, and then Ms. McLaughlin.
Chair, thank you. I quickly want to comment. Ms. Toll made the comment about Section 146.6 being academic in the context of the conversation on this bill. I agree with her. Just because I think she was looking for some sort of clarity there. 146.6 is important, but then if the committee decides to do so, the committee will deal with it differently. But in as much as this bill is concerned, we won't get to 146.6. Right. Quickly, I just want to, I know that it was not meant just because we are on the record, I just want to correct that I haven't conceded the competence of the province. What I've conceded was that there are no conflicts. The competence of the province to make the legislation has never been challenged. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Advocate LaRue.
I believe members of the public would have benefited from this type of discussion. However, as an educationist, I hope that this committee will not just consider the legal arguments, but also whether these amendments are actually preferable or not. I wanted to pose a couple of questions to the WCD. The first point is on intervention facilities. The WCD mentioned that children face various challenges and therefore it's impossible to clarify what therapeutic programs will be implemented. I'd just like to clarify how they see those type of challenges differing from, for instance, the types of challenges that learners attending childcare facilities would face, and why it's not possible to provide the type of clarity that the advocate mentioned is provided in the Children's Act, with regards to intervention facilities. When it comes to collaboration schools, I just wanted to ask the WCED if they have, if they're able to provide any other indicators of outcomes of the pilot project than the very superficial matric results that the MEC mentioned in the previous meeting. She mentioned that matric results had gone up and down without really clarifying how that specifically related to the intervention, as a variety of factors could have contributed to that. She also mentioned that at one of the schools, the matric results had gone down because the principal left the school, without mentioning that the principal actually left the school to join a school operating partner. So the principal left as a result of this program. Then I also wanted to ask the WCD, they've not once been able to clarify why this majority representation on the school governing body is necessary as implemented in collaboration schools. In fact, a school operating partner mentioned at the public hearings that they don't even want a majority representation. So why is the WCD insisting on this? And then finally, can they clarify in terms of donor-funded schools how it's preferable to allow a private, even with the possibility of it being a for-profit company, because remember, only school operating partners are limited to non-profits, not donors, who could also, in the case of donor-funded schools, receive a majority on school governing bodies, to provide them with a majority representation on those governing bodies without any clear indication of what the purpose of that is, apart from that they have money. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ms. McLaughlin. Over to the WCD.
I want to say something, Chair.
Member Mitchell.
Thank you, Chair. I didn't want to stop the member of the public while she was doing her submission, and I allowed that. But on a point of procedure, that is again part of a public participation process which we have now concluded. The agenda said the legal opinion. Those questions were not related to the legal opinion directly, and for that reason, Chair, I would propose that you don't allow WCED to answer that question, because it's part of the public hearing and public participation process, and we cannot open it up again. The closing date has been reached.
I take your point.
Can I just say something?
Yes.
You see, Chair, that's why I left it, because next week we're discussing the inputs.
Yes.
This was just for the legal opinion, and that's why I didn't pose the other questions, because we just wanted Advocate the Root to respond on that, and that is what we've done. So next week we can get into the debate why this, why that, and that. So that is next week. I thought, and that's why I just want to also bring that to your attention.
I thank you so much for bringing me in line as well. Member Mitchell and Christian, Ms. McLaughlin, your questions will be incorporated in the resolutions, the way forward. And McFarlane, I'm sorry, I said McLaughlin, Rene McLaughlin. McFarlane, it was one of my previous girlfriends, surname. So it will be taken forward in any case. Thank you so much. Member Olivier, do you have the last say?
Yes, I don't know. Chair, maybe the last say. I want to support what Member Christian is saying. Let's take note of those input and not lose it. And Chair, if this committee then agrees that the next meeting will then look at those comments, including those, and also look at what is also in this legal opinion, where in a number of areas it is mentioned, I do not comment on desirability. So I think that means we'll also have to look at those areas of desirability, not the legal aspects of the thing alone, but also whether it's desirable of my choosing this as well. But I think that would be next.
Yes.
But Chair, there was also a request from Member McKenzie that the one page, or whether it's an email or whatever, then on this resolution of these two legal submissions, that we have the one page that says this is what this opinion now is, where they agree, where they don't agree, whether Section 46 will kick in or not, that we have that on record for that next meeting. So that we look at that, that one page of submission, but also, Chair, deal now with what is important that came from the public as well at the next meeting.
Thank you, Member Olympic. You know, you're so passionate. Can I tell you, we are going to discuss some of these issues that have been raised, except the legislative issues, immediately after this meeting. So while the others have their refreshments, we are going to stay behind to discuss. Any other further questions? I think we've exhausted all the questions. Now, let's relax, sit back. Relax. I know it was a tiring day, you know, and we must take note. This is some good advice from an old man, gray. I have 70 gray hair, 73, by the way. Especially when it comes to this time of the year, we know it's a pressing time. There's a lot of pressure. There's a lot of stress. And one can lose focus, one can lose track of things, and I think we should keep things intact. So therefore, I want to thank all the members of the public, the WCED, all the support staff, the language practitioners, all who are involved. Thank you so much for the manner in which the meeting has been conducted. Especially the ambience, I could feel it, the spirit, and the spirit of goodwill, and I think this is what is important. Please allow me just one minute. A spirit of goodwill, irrespective of party political affiliation, religion, color, class, caste, it doesn't matter. We are here as bridge builders. We are here as nation builders. We are here to take the country forward. It's our beloved country. And it's the only one we have. And we are all going to take hands and make this country work for us. For all of us. And we are going to be a proud nation. And I thank you so much, Masima, for I called you in, I think, 5 times today. Just for support and also to console me a bit, because I was, I must admit, I was a bit edgy, didn't know what to expect, but wow, what it's a wow moment, and I can see the good in each of us, and that is what is important. And I must compliment you with the good in you. And the good things that you portray as South Africans. I'm not only talking about Western Cape residents residents of the metro. No. As South Africans with a clear vision, clear mission, we know what we're doing, we want to grow the economy, we want to make education work, we want to build each other, we want to take hands, we want to be friends, we don't want to fight, we don't want to make enemies, we don't want to go to war, the time for peace is now. And so thank you so much, WCD, in what you are doing, and we will implement and apply each and everything that will work and will be for the better of all our people. Advocate LaRue, thank you so much for your opinion and your response. Mr. Tor, thank you very much for what you did last week. Unfortunately, I missed out. So I think the two of us must have a special session, 2-hour session, alone together sometime. And the members of the public, thank you very much for buying out the time. Even in spite of the inclement weather that you turned up, you're more than welcome. Thank you so much. What is this, my head? Yes, we need to read, she said transport is starting at 11. The Department of Transport and Public Works is starting at 11.